I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Yuri Levine, co-founder of Waze, the crowdsourced traffic navigation app. Drivers share real-time traffic and road information to help other users on the same route. Yuri co-founded Waze in Israel in 2007, and the company was sold to Google in 2013 for $1.1 billion. Waze has roughly 150 million users and operates in countries ranging from Italy to Antarctica. Yuri is also the founder of FeeX, which also uses crowdsourced information, this time to uncover hidden fees in people's financial accounts. Prior to starting Waze, Yuri was an independent strategic consultant focused on the wireless industry. He is a graduate of Tel Aviv University. Welcome.
Thank you.
For those listeners who are not Wazers, how does Waze work?
The magic behind Waze is that it uses the same platform to collect information and to share that information amongst all the drivers. So when you drive, the system knows where you are and how fast you are driving and automatically calculate based on that all the traffic jams that are out there and help the rest of the drivers to avoid them. So in general, it helps you outsmart traffic jams.
The system is better depending upon the number of users.
Right. So obviously this requires critical mass of users, and the more users, the better accuracy of the data is, and then it's much easier to get even more users.
You've used the example before of a driver from Los Angeles Airport to the city, which usually takes over an hour. If they're using Waze, could take as little as 23, 26 minutes.
The reality is that as drivers, we don't know what we don't see, right? So you might be on the highway, on the 405 highway in that example, and you're stuck in traffic jams and the streets are going to be wide open and you don't even know that. And because there are other drivers that are currently driving on the streets, Waze does know that and can route you to avoid these major traffic jams or major accidents, or even on daily routines.
You know, sometimes I think about the people living in the houses of these once quiet streets, and now with the advent of GPS systems and Waze, all of a sudden you have all these fast cars moving through these once quiet streets, you know, to avoid the highways. It's just an interesting transition to some degree.
So, you know, if all the drivers would be using Waze, what the system will actually do is optimize traffic around the entire nation, right? And that will be the best optimizations for everyone, but not for a single person.
How does one confirm the veracity of the content?
So the content is being automatically confirmed by the number of users, right? So for example, if someone driving and report that there is an accident, then the next driver is actually going to get an alert telling him, be careful, there is an accident ahead of you, right? And then that next driver can confirm or basically say it's not there. And then the system basically collects this information very, very fast, depending, of course, on the number of users. And based on that, determines whether or not the information is accurate or not.
What is the ratio of passive users, people who simply have Waze open as they're driving, versus active users who are actually populating the maps with this information?
So most of the drivers are passive. But the fact that you're passive, you're still contributing the most important data, which is where you are and how fast you are driving. Mm-hmm. And this is maybe the magic of Waze, that while you drive, and you are not doing anything in purpose to help others, you actually do help others.
It's interesting. My husband is a relatively even-keeled person, but one of the things that gets to him viscerally, more than most anything I've seen, is traffic. Why do you think traffic is such a core frustration for so many?
So, you know, I can try other things as well, waiting in line is another thing.
But that's like traffic. It's the waiting.
Exactly. And so the waiting makes us feel helpless and useless. I actually do hate lines a lot. And I hate traffic jams as well.
The transaction with Google was considered one of the largest transactions in Israeli history. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that you put Israeli technology on the global map. Very cute. But before this transaction in 2013, you were three people in a little office north of Tel Aviv working on this app. And I want to talk about those early days. It was yourself, Amir, Shinar, and Ehud Shabtai. Is that correct?
That's right.
It was Ehud who received a GPS system from a friend, and he tried sharing speed cameras. And there was a company called MAPPA, which sent a letter saying that he violated copyright. They didn't want him using the maps. And that's when he said, well, we'll build our own. Can you talk to me about that?
So this is nearly accurate. What happened is that Ehud had a PDA with a navigation software on that. And he actually developed that part that allows people to mark where speed cams are. And he distributed it amongst friends and amongst readers of a forum. And these people actually helped to create the first, map of speed cams in Israel.
So what was MAPPA's issue exactly?
He was giving away that software for free and the ability to use the speed cams data for free. And they wanted to sell that for money.
I see. Okay. And they were a mapping company in Israel?
They are a mapping company in Israel. Then they asked him to remove that part. So he did remove that, and then he figured out, I actually want to do that, but I need the map. And so maybe the same way that the user helped me to create a map of speed cams, maybe they can help me to create the map of Israel.
So ironically, their cease and desist letter helped to fuel the germ of Waze, right?
Yes, exactly. And the first version started with a blank page, with actually borderlines of Israel. And when people started driving, they actually created the roads on the map. And if there are 100 people going into one direction and there is no one going the other direction, that the system automatically detects that that will be one-way street.
When you talk about starting out with a blank map of Israel and people populating it using the app, who were those initial people drawing the maps of the roads in Israel?
So, this is brilliant questions, because the key were who were these people, not what was the value for them. And they were people that cared about GPS and GIS and map data, and they were frustrated with the fact that maybe the map is inaccurate or outdated in their areas.
How did you find them?
Different forums. So for everything that there is enthusiastic amateurs, and this is their hobby, they exist online someplace.
So enthusiastic cartographers, basically?
Enthusiastic GPS lovers. So at the time, it was called FreeMap. And at the beginning, we had hundreds of users. That's it.
How about yourself? Would you and Ehud and Amir drive around in your car?
All of us did. And that was funny because when you realize how the system works and you're driving around and you see that there is a street out there, out of the window, and it's not on the map. And so immediately you turn into the street and you go back and forth a few times in order to create that road on the map. And that was pretty annoying for the family.
Tell me more about that. You have 5 children. Were they in the car with you?
Sometimes it was my ex-wife and some of the kids, and they were annoyed by the fact that, you're wasting their time and driving around and with no purpose. In the same fashion that no one likes to waste their time, they didn't like to waste that I am wasting their time either.
How did you meet your co-founders?
So someone set the meeting and basically say, I have the point of view, the strategic point of view, and they have an interesting concept and we should meet. After that, we started to meet on a regular basis, either at the office of Amir and Ehud or at my mom's apartment, actually. The living room was the garage where the most of the meeting happened at the beginning.
Your mom's living room was the initial office meeting point for Waze.
Yes.
Why'd you call it a garage?
Because there are no garages in Israel, and that was the perfect replacement for the garage.
Speaking of Israel, why was Israel an appropriate environment for a program like Waze to take off?
So, Israel is called a startup nation, and, the number of startups per capita in Israel is maybe second to the Silicon Valley, maybe even more than the Silicon Valley. And I think that it's part of our nature and the culture that startups are a way to express yourself, a way to to do something. And in general, there are a few things in the Israeli culture that's, that supports that.
Well, for one, there's the army, where you, you know, are trained to be resilient and to think in an amorphous situation.
Right. So, so, you know, in the army, one of the things that you learn is the fact that losing is not an option. And if you fail, you keep on trying. And you take all that as part of your adulthood.
What role did you play in the army, incidentally?
So I was actually a software developer at the army.
You mentioned before how you would drive around helping to create these maps. And there's a story of you helping to create the points where each of your potential investors lived. Can you tell that story briefly?
We have met quite a lot of the VCs in Israel, and one of them actually liked the solution that we are building, liked Waze a lot. We met them once, and we met them twice, and then they call us for all-hands meeting. And, you know, before that meeting, we figure out the home address of each one of the partners there. And we made sure that they're all on the map, and not only these houses on the map, also a few other houses on the same street. So it's not doesn't look like a mock-up, right? And during the meeting, when we explain how does it work, all of a sudden one of the partners is asking, so what you're telling me is that possible that my house is on the map? And I said, I don't know, tell me where you live and we will see, right? And deep inside, I knew that the house is there, right? Then we went to the map, and everyone is looking at the map, and I'm actually looking in his eyes, and I saw the dollar signs there immediately.
Do they know the story, by the way?
I told them that about a year ago.
Oh, okay. So this is after the sale to Google.
Yes.
Incidentally, while you were a consultant, did you have any feelings like, you know what, I don't feel like I'm going to be a consultant forever? Or were you perfectly fine staying a consultant? What was going on in your personal head at the time?
Helping other startups was a waiting position, right? So I was waiting for the right idea to come and maybe the right team to team up with. And when Amir and Ahud showed up with the idea and the ability to actually create a lot of more value with the real time of smartphones, then I thought that this is it, definitely it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yuri Levin, co-founder of Waze and FeeX. We'll hear more from Yuri coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Yuri Levin, co-founder of Waze, the crowdsourced traffic navigation app. Drivers share real-time traffic and road information to help other users on the same route. Yuri co-founded Waze in Israel in 2007, and the company was sold to Google in 2013 for $1.1 billion. Yuri is also the founder of FeeX, which also uses crowdsourced information, this time to uncover hidden fees in people's financial accounts. Prior to starting Waze, Yuri was an independent strategic consultant focused on the wireless industry. He is a graduate of Tel Aviv University. You filed roughly 15 patents, and I saw the earliest patent you filed was in 1999, which was for a voicemail system for a personal assistant provisioning. And it ranges from that to TV broadcast of live feed from mobile devices to, you know, what Waze is, which is really a community real-time information exchange. And so by looking at your patents, you can see kind of your own evolution of Yuri Levin.
So, you know, definitely we evolve over time. By the way, I didn't know that I filed 15 patents.
And your name is on 14 of them.
You're probably right, but I didn't remember that. There is definitely an evolution. In general, I'm a revolutionary person, and I don't like large organizations. You know, sometimes I would tell a CEO that there are three types of people that you don't want in your organization. You don't want a drama queen, you don't want a victim, and you don't want a non-conformist guy, and I am the non-conformist guy, so maybe it's time for you to fire me.
Speaking of non-conformists, after you sold the company to Google, you soon left. How long were you at Google before you left?
0 days. So I wasn't at Google. I left the day after the acquisition.
And how was that perceived?
I actually started VX before that, and I reduced my engagement that way to only 75% of the time. And so that was probably expected.
When did Google first approach you? When did you start to get confirmation from the buying community?
Negotiation with Google was very, very fast. And they approached us and they basically, put an offer on the table and we started the negotiation, and that was quite fast.
One of the theories around Google's buying the company versus Facebook was that it was a defensive play, that they were denying Facebook the ability to kind of amp up their mobile social networking for adults by buying it themselves. Can you talk to me a little bit about that period when you were talking to both Facebook and Google?
So, obviously we were talking to Google. The rest is more of a rumor, right? So no one actually ever confirmed any of those. The reality is that, I think that Google, they like the fact that Waze is focusing on the commuting and not necessarily on the maps. The maps becomes a significant asset of Waze, but the service was for commuters. You know, that was probably the most appealing thing for Google at the time.
There was also a rumor that you had predilection towards Google versus going with Facebook because they allowed the founding team to stay in Israel, that there was a real attachment to their country. Can you talk to me about that?
So it was important for us that that we will stay in Israel, or at least the product and the engineering. So most of the employees will stay in Israel. It was important also to the employees. They didn't want to leave.
I mean, your homes are there in Israel.
And the reality is that if the acquirer would ask everyone to move, probably half of the people wouldn't move and they would quit.
Just going back to the early days, when did you see a critical mass take shape where you said, this is really starting to work?
We officially launched the service in Israel beginning of 2009. And it seems to be working very nice there. And we had 20,000 users, and most of them were, in Tel Aviv area, and we started to see how traffic works. And then later that year, we launched in the U.S. and the rest of the world, and then it didn't work. And 2010 turns out to be the nightmare year for us because it was not good enough. We wouldn't find your home, right? We wouldn't find your office, or we wouldn't find a route that makes sense to you. And people try that and they believe in the dream, but the reality was not there.
We're talking about in Massachusetts or
right.
Washington.
Everywhere, right.
Why?
Because we didn't have enough users, because the map at the beginning is not good enough, because it takes time to mature, right? For each and every product, it takes time to mature, and it was not there. And so 2010 was very, very hard year for us. It was without the mission and the team, I think we might have been collapsed.
And you're thinking, well, that's okay. We just need more users. And once we have more users, things will be fine. Or did you also think, maybe this is the beginning of the end?
So we knew that we need more users, but we also knew that we need to actually focus on the conversion and the adoptions of these specific users. So we put all the efforts of the company in crossing that desert, collecting feedbacks from the users, collecting data and information and metrics from the system, figuring out what's wrong and go and fix that.
So what's an example of things that you fixed that worked?
So one of the things that we have learned is that the most important thing is for single users to actually get to see that the system improves for that person. We fix problems on the map much faster in places that were users than in other places. And the result was that the map improves for them faster and faster and faster, and we could get them more engaged. And what it did is that for more and more users, the first driver, the first time that they drove, the experience becomes good enough. Mm-hmm. And after a few good enough experience, then if all of a sudden you run into an experience that is less than good enough, then you're still much more forgiving than if your first time experience is a poor experience.
So what were some other changes in this desert of 2010 that really helped to put you on the map, or that really helped to change the course?
So realizing that the faster we move, the faster we make mistakes, the better we are. Doing that, and by the way, at the same time that we were still unsuccessful here, we have started to see some places that are ramping up. So maybe a few places in Latin America and maybe a few places in Europe that all of a sudden they were small enough that we were able to create the critical mass there.
And how about the capital that you raised? How much capital did you raise from venture capital?
So on 2008, we raised $12 million. And then 2010, we actually approaching the point of time that we need to raise additional capital and it's not working good enough. And that was hard. That was, if you think that the first round was hard, that was much harder. And eventually we were able to raise that funds. It was led by Microsoft at the time.
For how much?
$25 million. Uh-huh. So we raised a lot of capital at the end of 2010. And then moving into 2011, all of a sudden the dots were connected. All of a sudden, we turned out to be good enough, even in the U.S. and in a few places in Western Europe and so forth. And then somewhere in the middle of 2011, we raised additional capital from Horizons and Kleiner Perkins.
So you just made it over the tipping point in a way, where
yes,
things were working just well enough. Right?
Yes, one step at a time and little steps at the beginning, and then it started to accelerate. And at the beginning of 2010, user feedback would sound like, I really like the idea, but it doesn't work in my place. Towards the end of the year, we are starting to see more and more people that are saying, hey, this is working, and it's actually, tell me that there is a traffic jam, and the traffic jam is actually there, right? And so a lot of eureka moment, aha moments that we have heard from users, which was the, I think, the key driver for us to realize that we are on the right path.
And what was going on in your personal life at the time while this is going on professionally?
When you go into the journey of a startup, one of the things that you don't realize is how much you're going to sacrifice. You believe that you're going to change the world, and this is becoming the most important mission that you have in your life at this point of time, right? And obviously, if this is the most important mission, then the rest of the missions don't get the same attention.
You went through a divorce during this time?
So I went through a divorce in 2013.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yuri Levine, co-founder of Waze, the crowdsourced traffic information service that gives users real-time data so they can better navigate their driving route. Waze was sold to Google for $1.1 billion in cash in 2013. Yuri is also the co-founder of FeeX, which helps users uncover hidden fees associated with their financial accounts through the use of crowdsourced information. I want to talk about the art or the icons, the look and feel of Waze, which seems, in a way, cartoon or childlike, and like with the cloud-like figures moving around. What was your thinking around the look and feel of it?
So one of the things that we mentioned earlier, at the beginning, it's harder because the value is not there, and therefore we build some gamification into the application. So you collect points and you collect goodies along the route that you drive. And for many of the drivers, that was interesting enough to keep on driving, even though that maybe the route is not perfect, maybe the map is not perfect. We would use that in order to, send people to areas that need more drivers, and we would, populate them with goodies on the road. So as you drive them, you actually collect more and more and more points.
Because it does look like an adult candy land in a way.
Yes, to an extent.
And that was on purpose to create kind of the gaming feel to incentivize people to stay with the program.
Right. That was, but the idea was that will help people to use the application more, even when it's not perfect.
You mentioned before that your first meetings were in your mom's living room. What would your mom say about Yuri as a child? You mentioned that you're a nonconformist. What were you like growing up?
Nightmare. I would be skipping school. Terrible kid, terrible teenager that is very hard for you to deal with. But for my parents, there was a better recognition of the type of person I am and the fact that there are good advantages out of that.
What are some examples of nightmare?
Like the principal or the teacher would be calling my parents and asking where I am, right, or complaining about what I've done.
Like what?
let's see, driving without a license for many years, disappearing from school for a period of times, like arguing with teachers and everyone.
And did you feel like you were a nightmare in real time or in retrospect?
In retrospect, definitely. You know, at the time I thought that, you know, this is who I am, and I'm no different than the rest of the kids, even though that maybe I am, but you don't see that.
You spent 0 days at Google, as you said, before working more full-time on FIEX. And you had mentioned at some point that in 2009, you lost 20% of your portfolio, only to realize that you had to pay on top of that a 1.5% management fee. And that was, you know, one of the points of hurt for you to start this company. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
So 2008 was a terrible year on the market, and I've lost on my study fund 20%, and in addition they charged me 1.5% management fees, and I called them up and I said, look, I'm frustrated, right? Losing money is something that I can do by myself, right? I don't need you to lose my money, but you also charged me 1.5%, and what they did, they refund me the fees. And so initially I was very happy with the fact that at least I recovered some of the losses, right? But then I started to ask myself, why are they doing that? And I started to ask my friends how much fees you are paying. And they didn't know. None of my friends actually know how much fees they're paying. And then I started to realize, hey, it's a big thing here. If no one knows, and these are all smart people, and these are all adult people, and they should have known, and they don't. And I didn't know either. And so that was the initial thought around that, maybe there is something that can be done. And it was only until 2011 that I actually found the time to start building FIEX. So that was, you know, the first indication. The second indication was I was starting to explore how much fees I'm paying at the bank. And again, I started to ask my friends, and one of them told me that they get 90% discount on the bank fees, but I shouldn't be telling that to anyone. And I asked him why, and he said, you know, the bank told me not to tell anyone.
This is in Israel.
And so we started to investigate more, and we figure out that there's actually about 4% of the GDP in fees in Israel. And it's the same here, 4% of the GDP. It's $600 billion of fees that American pays every year. This is more than the construction industry, right? This is more than the entertainment industry. It's like an industry by itself, which is only fees.
And by the way, we don't disagree that there should be some fee. It's just that people should know what the fee is, right? I mean, because there are professionals doing some management of your money and should be remunerated. But you're talking about it's egregious that you don't know sometimes what the fees are or that they're too high.
So definitely there should be some sort of fees, but they should be, you know, mentioned in dollars, not in basis points or X ratio or other terms that you don't even know. You know, I'm pretty sure that if we will walk throughout this floor and we will ask people how much fees they're paying, they wouldn't know. And the reality is that an average American is going to lose about one-third of their retirement saving in fees. Hmm. One-third.
And what has been harder for you than you thought about FIEX, this, you know, the second time around?
So I mentioned two critical things. The last thing that actually, based on that, I decided that I'm going to do FIEX was when my dad passed away about 8 years ago. And when I was at my mom's place, I was actually looking at the statement 2 years ago, at the statement of one of his accounts. And I've noticed that he's being charged a lot of money in fees. And I called him up and they said, we would like to speak to him. And I said, you know what, I would like to speak to him as well, but this is going to be very hard.
Because he died a few years ago.
Right. And then they said, okay, we cannot give a discount to someone that already died. And I asked them, are you sure that you can collect fees from someone that has already died? And we had 3 weeks of arguments, and eventually they refund the fees and discounted moving further. And I say to myself, you know, if it's not for us, I'm going to do that for our parents.
On a lighter note, you like to ski.
A lot.
Tell me about that.
I like the speed. You know, I started late. I started only when I was 20-something. One of the things that I've promised myself is that after the acquisition, I'm going to go for the whole season skiing. And I didn't, because that was after I got divorced and I didn't want to be away from the kids for that period of time. So last year I was skiing about 8 weeks. Mm. A week of skiing, a week at home, a week of skiing, a week at home.
Where do you go?
Usually the Alps, but mm-hmm. I would go anywhere, anywhere that there is good snow.
What else brings you joy?
So I like to play basketball. And I'm riding my bicycle most of the time. That's because I hate traffic jams.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Yuri Levine, co-founder of Waze. Coming up, we'll meet Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a condiment company. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a ketchup company. Mark and his co-founder Scott Norton thought, why shouldn't there be a gourmet alternative to Heinz ketchup, and started tinkering with recipes in their off-campus apartment while they were students at Brown University. Sir Kensington's was launched in 2010, and the product is available in stores throughout the United States, including Williams-Sonoma, Dean & DeLuca, and Whole Foods. The product is also available in more than 500 restaurants and hotels. Sir Kensington's also makes other condiments, including mustard and mayo. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start in September 2004 with an article written in the New Yorker magazine by Malcolm Gladwell called The Ketchup Conundrum. Basically, the gist of it was that while mustards enjoyed a variety of flavors and various companies made them, ketchup could not share that same diversity. Only Heinz had kind of this perfect blend of sweetness and sourness and bitterness and saltiness, in addition to mouthfeel, which is called umami. Can you tell me about your first encounter with that article?
Yeah, we had this idea of ketchup long after that article came out. We didn't read it in 2004. We were in high school and we weren't highbrow enough. And we had this idea when we were seniors in college in 2007, 2008. The article was brought to our attention. We read it and we thought it was very interesting. I think, you know, in many ways, the food world is very different than where it was in 2004. You know, in 2004, Chobani didn't exist. Coconut water didn't exist in America. You know, so many things have changed since then. So, you know, when we were reading it, we had a very different perspective on what's possible. We thought that he made a lot of great points around product. Ketchup is a very nostalgic flavor. The mouthfeel, like you said, those things are really innate in people. What stood out to us is that there wasn't a lot of discussion around brand, whereas Grey Poupon really has a fantastic brand and was, he mentions, as sort of a breakout star of the mustard category. We didn't really perceive there to be a lot of ketchup brands that were doing something interesting in the same way.
He talks about this concept amplitude, which basically is a balance of flavors, and that Heinz had a high amplitude. And I have to admit something embarrassing, which is that the article came out a month before I was married, and I thought when I was giving a speech at my wedding, what am I going to say? And I used this concept of amplitude about my husband in my wedding speech.
That sounds perfect. Yeah, completely perfect. Yeah. You know, amplitude is present in everything that we eat, everything we consume, right? It's sort of, in the way that it's talked about in the article, it's sort of how intense can the flavors be, and how often do you want to keep going back to that flavor, or how long does it take you to get tired of it? Mm-hmm. And I think Coca-Cola has a lot of that, has a lot of amplitude. You don't taste one thing in Coke. You taste many things. And so for me, having something that has high amplitude means it's balanced.
The article wasn't the germ or the inspiration for you to launch the company. How did you get the idea to start the ketchup company while you were at Brown?
Yeah. Well, the legendary answer is that we were reading about Sir Kensington in history class, and he was part of the British aristocracy and quite a culinaire. And there was a long-lost recipe that he had sort of helped develop after he went to a dinner party at the home of Catherine the Great, and he was served a ketchup that was subpar, so he needed to make his own, and we brought that back to life. Mm-hmm. The real story is that we had the idea to start the company just in the course of normal conversations around food. I mean, we were both I have a Lebanese and British family. He has an Armenian family. And so there was always cooking going on growing up and lots of family feasts, and food was always a very central part of our lives. But we were both econ majors. So we were always talking about food ideas and ways to sort of find the intersection there. And we were just saying how weird it was that if you go to the grocery store, you're overwhelmed with choice, you know, whether it's cereal or yogurt or salsa or milk. But in this one category that is in 97% of American homes, we didn't think there was any choice.
By the way, we talk about Heinz as this, you know, behemoth, incumbent. But Henry Heinz was a maverick of sorts. You know, in the late 19th century, there was a preservative in ketchup called benzoate. And he contended that this was actually not good for your health. And he replaced the preservative with vinegar, basically pickling the tomatoes. And he won out. But it was because of his moxie that Heinz was born.
Yeah, I mean, the story of H.J. Heinz is incredible. And we're lucky that we don't live in the world of the late 19th century. The food world was scary. I mean, before truth in advertising laws and before sort of consumer protection, that people were putting all sorts of stuff in food, making all sorts of claims. And food was, in general, not super safe. And H.J. Heinz was really one of the first entrepreneurs to take food safety very seriously. And that was the origin of the glass bottle, which was he wanted to make sure people knew that he was proud to show what was inside. And so I think that, that resonates with us.
Heinz is this iconic Americana brand, and you sought out to do something distinctly different by making this absurdly highbrow, making fun of yourself, but foodie-oriented condiment. When we say that you tinkered with recipes during college, tell me more about that.
Yeah, so it was the spring semester of our senior year. Neither of us were writing any sort of thesis, so we had plenty of time. And we just started Googling ketchup recipes. And we had really no cooking background at all. I think at most I had cooked pasta in college, and Scott had probably cooked less than that. But he had an off-campus apartment with a stove. Ketchup, to make it, in theory it's easy. In practice, it was extremely difficult. We didn't even have aprons, so we cut up trash bags to use as aprons. We didn't have proper gloves, so we used oven mitts. You know, we didn't have any pot bigger than a saucepan, so it took us weeks and weeks. And I think that off-campus apartment still smells like tomatoes. And we developed 8 different recipes that we thought were pretty good. And we hosted a series of tasting parties with our friends. And our first tasting party was the night of the biggest blizzard that Brown had seen in years. But people showed up with snow pants under their dresses, and they helped us taste all these ketchups and give us their feedback.
What is a Kensington kiss?
So Kensington kiss was the result of not having proper protection while cooking ketchup. We didn't have, the right aprons, gloves, or whatever. So a Kensington kiss is what we called the burn marks on our skin when the hot tomato ketchup would boil off and splatter all over us.
So this is senior year of college, and you both went off to do different things prior to starting the company. You worked at McKinsey in New York after graduation, and Scott went on this bicycle ride throughout the Middle East and Europe. At what point did you come back to this idea of starting the company?
As we were graduating, the idea was sort of what we thought was coming to a close. We made 2 formulas that we thought were great. We had a big launch party, sold all the jars we made, and that was going to be it. But we had a lot of friends who were saying, this is a cool idea. You should at least keep working on it. So actually, over the course of 2008 to 2010, we worked nights and weekends on Skype and however we could get in touch, really putting all the puzzle pieces together. And then in 2010, we had gotten it to a point where we felt like it was just waiting for someone to take it over. So I quit my job in June of 2010, and he joined in October.
We talk about the legendary start of Sir Kensington's. How did you come up with the idea of being tongue-in-cheek and being, what you called absurdly highbrow in getting the concept off the ground?
When I was growing up, I was always attracted to brands that had personalities. That doesn't necessarily mean literal figurative personalities like a Mr. Peanut. But I think brands need to make statements, and Heinz clearly makes a statement. It stands for childhood, it stands for nostalgia, it stands for fun, and really, it stands for Americana. And we didn't want to go right up against that. And I think, as much as food is about quality and taste, it's also about entertainment. So we didn't want to make anything that we didn't want to take ourselves too seriously. So Sir Kensington evolved as this character that hearkened to British quality and British cuisine, which in some ways isn't looked at as the best cuisine in the world, but it's certainly looked at as sort of like high tea and, you know, it's the origin of a lot of things fancy. And Sir Kensington was this character that personified these sort of tongue-in-cheek ideas that you could have quality even in the lowliest of things.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a condiment company that got its start by making a ketchup that hoped to be a gourmet alternative to Heinz. What is the history of ketchup?
Ketchup actually is a 500-year-old condiment. It started as a fish sauce in Southeast Asia. It's originally a Chinese word. I think it's pronounced ketsiop. And it sort of migrated with the spice trade from Southeast Asia through Central Asia. And it eventually incorporated tomatoes, which are a new world crop. The tomatoes are from Peru. The Europeans brought tomatoes back to Europe, needed a way to preserve them. And ketchup eventually made its way to America.
So in 2010, you and Scott decide to launch the company officially. You debuted at the Fancy Food Show. And how pivotal was that for you?
For us, that was that little 4-foot table that I was standing behind with my sister made all the difference. That's where we met Whole Foods. That's where we met Dean and DeLuca. That's where we met Williams-Sonoma. And I think in many ways we were incredibly lucky that they stopped by because we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't know how pricing worked. We didn't know what distribution was. I mean, we didn't even have a warehouse. The first order of product arrived at my apartment doorstep, and it was a pallet. I didn't even know what a pallet was. I was in a doorman building at the time. Doorman called and said, "You have a delivery." I said, "Oh, great. You can just put it in the packages room." And he's like, no. This is thousands of pounds of I don't know what. And so I had to come back and I sort of helped him unload it and put it all in my apartment. So I had a wall of ketchup in the apartment at the time.
What was harder for you initially than you thought it might be?
Well, sales were hard, still are hard. And so we were taking our cases of product door to door up and down streets of New York to places like Murray's Cheese, places like the Chelsea Market. You know, but it was hard, though, because people are busy. They see a million products a day. It's only gotten worse. These jars of ketchup were heavy, so I had them in a roll of like a rolling suitcase. And I would go into these stores, and the stores would be filled with people. I mean, it's Manhattan, so there's no room for anything. And I'm in there with my suitcase trying to get them to taste this or see this. And they, you know, they just say, "I'll leave a sample and I'll call you back." And the nice people do. But most people, even if they are nice, are too busy to call you back. Figuring out that you have to sort of be persistent while still being nice was a tricky balance to find.
Any interesting anecdotes about, you know, approaching Murray's Cheese or, you know, you mentioned Chelsea Market or, I don't know, anything that sticks out?
Well, I think the first thing is our very first New York retailer was Chelsea Market Baskets, which is a store still there, great store in Chelsea Market. And he was willing to put it up on shelf. We had most of the product in my apartment. We had some product in a warehouse near where Scott and Brandon were from in Northern California. And so our first attempt to ship, we didn't know that you had to pack glass properly. And we would get these irate calls. You know, I have a box that's bleeding ketchup. There's glass everywhere. What are you doing? And so I had to start hand delivering every week, you know, these boxes of ketchup all around the city because we had no other solution.
How did you finance the company in the early days?
In the early days, we put in our own money. It was me, Scott, Brandon, and there was a fourth partner named Wynn, who was also a college friend of ours. But as soon as I decided to leave my job and do this full time, we started to raise a bit of money from family and friends. We tried to raise money from people who were not just supportive, but had done something like this before. So some of our investors have also invested in brands like Pop Chips and Vita Coco, and we've tried to raise money from people who know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so to the degree that we can continue to raise from people like that, that's going to help.
What are some mistakes that were made that perhaps, you know, they helped with?
It hasn't all been easy. We've made a lot of mistakes. One of those mistakes is saying yes to every store that wanted to stock us right away. It was certainly in the early days just an amazing compliment. So we said yes to everyone. And so very quickly we had product in Arizona, in Texas, in Maine, in New York, California, all around the country. And I think the dirty secret of the food world is you have to be ready to support that. Mm. You know, things don't just fly off the shelf. And so we learned the hard way over the course of 2 years. We were getting into more and more stores. We weren't really paying attention to once it got on the shelf, was it getting off the shelf? Did anyone know about it? Was anyone willing to pay? And so we had to go through a period of really pulling back. And it was actually one of our board members who has done this before who said you should really lean into your best customers. And for us, that was Whole Foods.
What are the sorts of things you did other than, you know, stand there and demo, allow people to try the product?
Stores, in many ways, make their money off of vendors, not off of the people who are buying stuff in their stores. So a lot of stores, they'll charge what are called slotting fees, which are, you know, you have to pay just a flat fee to get your product on the shelf. But then to move it, you can do things like demos. But also, anytime you walk into a store and you see a display, you know, at the end of an aisle or sort of by checkout, that's usually paid for. And so being able to have that kind of placement makes you a little more attractive, certainly more visible, because it's also on sale. We found that that has the biggest impact on sales, and also hardest to get, because everyone's done this math. Everyone wants those kinds of displays.
Do you have any better answers for why Heinz dominated the market for so long, other than this amplitude answer that Malcolm Gladwell has?
I think that Heinz built their brand brilliantly by being ubiquitous. You know, something like 70 to 75% of all ketchup is consumed in food service, not in retail. So food service is basically anywhere you get ketchup for free. Restaurants, hotels, travel, schools, whatever. And it's usually Heinz. And so when you go to buy ketchup at home, you're going to buy what you're familiar with. And so for us, from the very, very beginning, it was always about how do we work with restaurants and how do we be omnipresent?
You're in more than 500 restaurants across the United States. What are one or two stories about getting the ketchup, getting your ketchup into one of those restaurants?
Our big break, I would say, on the restaurant side is working with PJ Clark's. I mean, they're an institution for burgers, and they've been serving the burger since 1884 with Heinz. I mean, the chef, his name is Mike DeFonso, phenomenally nice guy, very busy guy. And this was really our first lesson in how to sell in restaurants. There's no sort of process there. So we showed up, he tasted it, he said it was great, said he would call us, didn't call us, busy guy. So actually for like 4 months straight, we would just keep showing up at his doorstep. And he would always laugh and he'd say, "You guys, what do you want again?" And then eventually he said, "I want to do it, but my boss won't let me," the owner, this guy, Phil Scotty. And then, you know, for another 6 months, we were going back and over, trying to get a meeting with him, kept getting blown off. And then finally, he allowed us 5 minutes in his office. And the first thing he said to us, and he was this like legendary guy in our life, right? Almost a year trying to reach this man, Phil. He turns to us and he says, "You are the most f-ing persistent guys I have ever met. What do you have for me?" And so we told him our story very briefly, and he was a smoker at the time, and we gave him an engraved Zippo lighter with PJ Clark's on it, and it was really sort of the way to his heart. And we're now very close to him and his wife Thea, who's been like a godmother to us, and it all happened, and it was all because it was non-traditionally persistent.
I noticed that you're married. You have a ring. When did that happen?
Well, what's funny is I spent 2008 to 2010 at McKinsey desperately trying to find a girlfriend, and I couldn't. And the moment that I quit to start Sir Kensington's, I decided now I really should be single so I can really focus my time on building Sir Kensington's. And then at the Fancy Food Show, I met Rachel, who is now my wife.
What was she doing at the Fancy Food Show?
At the time, she was a partner at a design firm. And so they were looking at packaging and trying to find cool, interesting new clients. And she and her boss had stopped by. They were too expensive for us, so we started dating instead. And now we're married.
What might I not know about you? What do you enjoy doing outside of work?
Well, I love spending time with Rachel. I also love cocktail culture. I was very briefly a bartender at a bar downtown called White Star. And I learned how to chisel ice from Sasha Petrosky, who's the founder of Milk and Honey, the seminal sort of pre-prohibition or prohibition-style cocktail bar in New York. And I started doing these bar nights in my apartment while I was at McKinsey. The whole idea was to create a space that was fun and was lubricated, but not insane. You know, wasn't sort of a 10 shots for $5 kind of place, and but also not the kind of place where you had to whisper. And over time, it took on sort of a life of its own, and I created a menu, and people were bringing people I had never met before, and it got up to something like 40 people, and I had almost 100 bottles of liquor in my apartment. And it lasted for almost a year, and it had a name. It was called Mark Bar. I have plans to have sort of an underground bar component to Rachel's Cafe when it finally launches.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.